Hello and welcome to the Service Accommodation Property Podcast. Okay, so our keynote speaker today is Richard Stone. Richard's been in construction for 40 years. He's completed over £300 million worth of projects. He's done over 3,500 refurbs. This talk is about the CDM construction design and management of projects, and it's going to help you with your property developments and maximize your profit. So an awful lot of you have got interest in doing new build development into service accommodation, commercial conversions into service accommodation. This is definitely going to help you move into that part of service accommodation property investing.
Welcome to the Serviced Accommodation Property Podcast. This podcast by Kevin Paneskis, also known as the Property Soldier, covers all aspects of serviced accommodation and how to make it a profitable and sustainable business. Kevin started investing in property in 1991 whilst serving in the British Army and now owns a multi-million pound property portfolio and serviced accommodation business and is a best-selling author. And now your host, Kevin Paneskis.
There you go. That's the first faux pas out of the way. So I'm going to talk about CDM regs and why they're so important to you guys. And the reason they're so important is because I would rather assume most of you like your own beds at night. And not complying with them, whether it's through the fact that you don't know, which I get, a lot of people don't know, because there's all stuff that we don't know, or whether you choose to not comply with them because you do know and actually you haven't got the money in your project to comply with them, the HSE don't really care about that. They're not interested in whether you know about it or not. They're interested in whether you've complied with it. And it doesn't have to be hard to comply with this stuff. If you're doing a 50 grand refurbishment project, they don't expect you to have a site compound the size of what they use to build the Olympic Stadium. But what they do expect is that you have a minimum level of compliance. So let's have a show of hands. Who's ever actually heard of CDM regulations? Cool. So we've got some people who know. Who's in the room actually done a refurbishment project? Let's have a show of hands for who's done a refurb. So more people than know what CDM is. So, cool. CDM is one of the instruments. It's not the be-all and end-all for construction health and safety, but it's also not the be-all and end-all for just the health and safety part of the regulations that exist in the construction industry. And if I asked you to put your hand up and say, who here thinks they're in the construction industry? Put your hand up. Who here thinks they're in the property industry? Put your hand up. Okay. If you're in property and you're doing refurbs, you're in the construction industry. Whether you choose to be, like I do, and where I've been for 40 years since I was 5, or not, and I have actually got a picture of it, but I wouldn't show it because I'm talking about health and safety and being in a footing at 5 years old probably is a bit oxymoronic. But whether you choose to be in the construction industry or not, by virtue of the fact that you're refurbishing property for commercial gain, puts you fairly and squarely in the construction industry, which means that all of the health and safety regulations apply, but it also means that the CIS scheme applies. So who here knows what the CIS scheme relates to? Who's put your hands up? Brilliant. If you don't administer your accounts on a construction project in accordance with that, and the HMRC find out, so the revenue and tax man, and then at some point later on down the line, they come along and say, that's great, you've done a refurb, say it's 100 grand, so 50% of that's labour, 20% of it's profit, 30% is materials. What they'll say to you is, thanks, but all of those subcontractors that you've paid that you haven't verified, which by law you have to because you're in the construction industry, we want 30% of that. And by the way, we'd like it next week. Where's that 30% of 50 grand going to come from? Who's got that amount of money in their deal to suffer that kind of buffer? But I wouldn't mind hazarding a guess that none of you realised that actually the CIS scheme related to you in property. Who knew that that was a thing? One person. Cool. But it's not actually hard to comply with it. And the real bonus, actually, out of complying with that, is that who here finds it hard to find decent tradesmen? Greg, you can exempt yourself. Right. It's not easy, is it? You know, as a main contractor, it's one of our challenges is finding decent tradesmen. But by registering with that scheme and setting out when you go out to tender for projects and saying to people, look, this is who we are, this is what we do, and please can we have your verification details? Anybody that are kind of the people you don't really want to be contracting with are either going to run a mile and not return a tender, or probably might give you a bit of verbal. But either way, what that means is when you come to place an order with somebody, all of those people have automatically disqualified themselves from engaging with you to do the job. So you're straight away actually further forward than you thought you were, because half of the people you wouldn't want to do the work with and wouldn't want to engage with because there's a bigger risk of them something happening with that person have taken themselves out of the equation. So you're much more likely to be successful just by that one simple act. And what it also means is that actually, if you look at like macro cash flow, you have to do your CIS return at the end of the month and submit the tax. I think it's 2 weeks later, to be honest, our accountant does it. But if you're paying subcontractors weekly, which a lot of people do on smaller refurbs, and you're deducting that tax, that money's in your bank a lot longer. Well, when you're cash flowing big construction projects, over 100 grand, where your weekly net flow is in cash actually does impact on how much interest you're paying on the money you're borrowing. So not only is it helpful in terms of pre-qualifying and getting good quality subcontractors, but it does actually put money back in your pocket at the end of the day as well. And health and safety is a really boring subject, but it doesn't have to be that hard to implement. Engaging with the right people, it's, you know, getting CDM stuff sorted out before you start on site is law. You have to do it. I did a webinar last night and I polled the audience and there were 50 people plus who said, we didn't even think about planning a job before we did it. They just start refurbs. Now, I get that this is the world I work in all day, every day. So to me, that is absolute lunacy. But to a lot of people, that's just normality. You know, you get the obligatory Facebook post, and we've done it with pictures of the keys because we've got the keys and we want to get cracking. But spending a couple of days at the beginning before you actually start what you're going to work on will save you time once you get onto site. And I know Greg designs kitchens and puts lovely drawings and lines on pieces of paper to articulate what he's doing. Getting the right set of drawings done on any job will save you money. You don't have to go and spend £10,000 with an architect, but just getting simple layouts done for your services, for where your wall positions are going, will save you money, because moving a line on a bit of paper is a lot cheaper than moving a wall on site. And yet people don't do it, because they're desperately keen to get started and actually get their project moving forward. Getting the time spent in the planning stage will save you and pay you absolute dividends moving forward. Not only because it will de-risk your design, you'll see things that actually then you'll think, well, that doesn't make sense. But it will also save you money, because if you've got a proper pack of design information, you can actually go out to contractors and say, right, here's a suite of documents. Can we have a price for that package, please? As opposed to what a lot of people do, which is turn up at the property with a set of keys, whiz around with an electrician and a plumber and say, can I have a price for this, please? And they might get one or two prices for that trade package. And we'd line up tenders all day, every day for trade packages is what we do. And we see massive variance. And we have complete sets of contract documents that we go out to tender on. And even with that, we get massive variances. We priced the job last year, we had five scaffold prices back, and they ranged from 90 grand to £300,000. That was with a full set of drawings, a full scaffold schedule, and a complete set of materials and workmanship and attendances and an MBS specification about how the job had to be built. So if we can see that amount of variance, given that level of quality of document, what kind of variance do you think you're going to get if you don't have that level of detail at the outset? And you can't know that you're paying the right price. And you're probably thinking, well, why does this matter, Stoney? Well, it matters for two reasons. One, if you're spending your own money, you're spending either your inheritance or money that you're going to leave to your children in terms of a legacy. So do you not want to spend that wisely? But who here in the room works with investors? Let's have a show of hands who works with investors. Right. So you're spending someone else's money, effectively, on commissioning building services. So if further on down the line that person comes back to you and says, well, okay, the job's gone over budget, or it's not quite turned out, or can you please demonstrate to us how you've invested our money wisely, and you've only got one price for each trade, how can you possibly demonstrate that you've gone and got secured best value for that person's money? It's a physical impossibility. And to put some context around that, if you send a price out for a package, say, let's call it electrics, and you send that out to five companies, and you get, say you get three prices back, you get one at 30 grand, one at 35 grand, and one at 40,000. Who here would place the order with a company for 35k? Let's have a show of hands for anyone that would think 35k is the right price. Be in the middle of the road. What a lot of people would do is go for the lower price. Who would use the lower price? Who would use the most expensive price? Or who's just really not engaged with what I'm talking about? It's not, absolutely right. But 95% of people don't. They're driven by price, they're price buying. And the problem is that prices get massively distorted. I've seen, I don't know if anyone else has, but there's been a lot of claims recently where the competitions and mergers people are looking at actually what's going on with some of the biggest industry packages, because there's all manner of price fixing, price covering, cover pricing, collusion. So if you've got four, say you've sent out for five prices, you get three prices back, and you think, well, the middle of the road price is 30 grand. But you don't know whether the company at 40,000 didn't want the job. So they've rang the company at 30 grand and said, give us a cover price. And they went, well, we're going to go in at 30. So they go in at 40. But the company at 30 grand, their estimate, his wife's just had a baby, he's just thrown some numbers out with a Benson Edges watermark because he's too busy, and he's missed half a job out. So if he's missed half a job out, the right price can't be 30,000 because he's missed half the work. The right price isn't 35 grand. He's missed loads of the work. The right price is actually £40,000. Which is great because you think you've got a bargain. But when you get halfway through the job and that subcontractor actually has run out of money and they can't deliver, where is that going to leave your project? Most people buy on price without thinking about, actually, can the company deliver this? Have they got, we use an acronym called SCATE, skills, knowledge, attitude, training, and experience. You can swap, some people swap out experience for education, but personally, I think that's wrong, because one of the challenges we see a lot of people come up with when they're looking to work with contractors is they'll say, well, okay, we've got a scheme we want to build, and it's £1 million. So the company we want to place the order with turns over 4 million quid, so therefore there's no risk. Well, that's great, but if the company turns over 4 million quid but they work on the railway and you want them to go and do a commercial conversion, how much of that experience is actually transferable? None. And this stuff happens. This stuff goes down every week. 7 or 8 years ago, I think it was, I was working for a business, and we were doing a care home conversion. Only just, literally just started. Been on site for probably about 4 weeks, doing a soft strip and demolition. We had no design responsibility at all. We had a proper JCT, I think it was a minor works 16 contract, with the client. They'd gone off and employed their own design team. So they've got a principal designer, they've got a structural engineer, they've got an architect, all manner of different internal people, building control, compliance team, acousticians, all sorts of people. We had a demolition drawing that showed what walls had got to come out. We walked through with a proper bona fide, one of the biggest demo companies in the country, who were the subcontractor to do it, set all the walls out, everything was sprayed up. We had bobcats in there demoing walls, because these were like 9-inch concrete walls. And on the very last day, when buildings get finished, who's heard of the phrase a topping out ceremony when a building gets finished? Yeah. So it's normally a bit of a party for basically the design team to go, aren't we great? We've built this building. No, you've sat behind a desk while the builders built the building, but they still have a big party and drinks and stuff. In the demolition world, those guys are way off site by the time the building gets finished. So they have what they call an inverse topping out ceremony, which is they get the building knocked down, then they're going to have a beer. And quite often these days, in like social media times, they'll record what's going on. So they've got the foreman in the corner of a room with a camera on a phone, filming what was going on in this room. And the site manager, so I was operations manager, there was contracts manager, site guys on running projects, was starting another project. Was finishing another project. So before he left to go to a meeting, he said to the ganger man for the demo company, do me a favour, you're going to have an early off anyway, can you just clear the room out of all the rubble that's like 3 foot deep, because we want it to be nice and clean and tidy in a safe working environment. So he said, yeah, no problem, I'll do that. I bet you can guess what's coming next, right? Demolition guys love an early bath. So they didn't clear all the rubble out of the bottom of the floor. 3 foot deep. So it's this deep in breeze blocks, bits of old conduit, all manner of crap. And there's two guys with Kangos, Kangoing a wall like that, but a bit longer, but it went from that end of the wall to there. And anybody who's ever been on the tools knows that when you're taking walls down, there's a certain sound that they make. And when the load on a building changes, so does that sound. And I had to witness listening to this video and watching what happened next. And that was that these two guys can go on this wall down. As the last part of the wall came down, so did 14 tons of pre-stressed precast concrete on their heads and pinned them to the floor. Now the guys, they're all okay, thankfully, amazingly. Would you like me to tell you how that happened? So the client, one of the biggest G15 housing associations in the country, went out to tender to get a structural engineer to design the demolition plan. So one of the people in the office went online, literally Google structural engineer nearest to this job, because the client, being a housing association, they wanted to save money. So they thought, we'll get someone local to the job, there won't be much travel cost. They sent emails out to five companies. They got three replies, I think it was. They appointed someone on exchange of emails with no professional services agreement, which is absolute car crash recipe number one. No one thought to check that person's structural engineer's qualifications and that he was registered with the ICE at all. And they sent him a client brief and said, this is what we want. The guy had less qualifications than someone that teaches you to drive a car. But he had the brass neck to set up in the UK as a civil engineer and a structural engineer, dual qualified allegedly. And when he was paid £2,000 to travel to that site and open up the suspended ceiling, so a ceiling like this, and look at which way the beams were spanning, and the building had three separate wings to it, he decided that his fee for £2,000 for a day was quite nice, but he actually only wanted to be on site for a couple of hours. So he just lifted four ceiling tiles, I believe it was, in one area, and assumed from that all of the plank arrangements were the same throughout the whole of the building. And they weren't. Because when the building had been built, there was an error with how the design had been communicated. And this is why CDM is so important. The planks that had turned up to site were 80% right, but some of them weren't, and they changed the way the planks span on site. The site manager made a decision to change it. But that decision was never recorded anywhere. Not that anybody actually bothered to look whether that decision was recorded anywhere, because the client's mindset was, we've employed a professional to go and do this for us. That person decided to negligently not fulfill their responsibilities, that day nearly killed four people. And the only thing that saved those guys' life, the rubble on the floor. And they managed to crawl their way out through that. But that isn't the actual moral of the story. How long do you think that job was on hold for while that mess got unwound. Yeah, 11 months it was on hold for. That's a housing association using their own building. Could you imagine? I mean, our contract was over £1 million. But imagine you'd bought that site and you'd committed £1 million to spend on building work. You're going to have £3 million of someone else's money sitting on risk that you're going to be paying the interest on. And because of something that's happened, you can't make meaningful progress, so you can't get that done. So you can't refinance that at the back end that everybody talks about, where it's been really sexy and we all make shit tons of money, because the building's not finished. And the worst thing as well is that actually the people that you've gone and borrowed the money from that you're not drawing down will be charging you non-use fees. So you'll be paying not to use the money that you've borrowed. Where are you going to fund that from? Employing people is a really, really big thing. And yet people choose to not do it, choose to just haphazardly say, oh, well, okay, my brother's cousin's sister's an architect. I'll get them to do it. I myself, in the last 6 weeks, have seen someone stand on stage, not at Progressive, but somewhere else, and I've listened to someone talk for an hour about what an amazing architect they are and how they've got all these schemes and they've got 20 different sets of CGIs. Person hasn't even got any GCSEs. Not an architect. Not an architectural technologist. But people were falling over themselves in that room to go, that looks amazing, we want you to design that for us. Because people get sold on a concept, and this happens so often in property, people trip over themselves to get to the end really quick and for the big sexy stuff. And I get that, you know, we do property ourselves. My wife's over there absolutely like thinking, oh my God, I've got to listen to him carry on talking. I get that, you know, you get het up in the moment, it's really, you know, really exciting. But putting the important stuff in place at the beginning, that's the stuff that will give you the surety at the end. And those two are not isolated instances. I was involved in a claim for a job probably about 14 years ago now, where we took two big villas in Earls Court for the YMCA and converted it into a monster great big hostel. And we had a disagreement with a structural engineer that cost the client a 150-day delay that they had to pay us nearly £2,000 a day for. £300k in extra profit that we got for doing nothing. Because that was the impact of all of the design changes that this cowboy made, because he couldn't design anything. Because what he asked us to do was to take two massive great big villas with a 14-inch solid wall in between them. It was a solid brick party wall. And take that whole wall out front to back. Now, it looked amazing. The architect, who's an RABI architect, did an amazing scheme. And when it was finished, it won awards. But it was an absolute miracle that the thing never collapsed. And that's why we got asked to go in and sort it out. Because the structural engineer decided, in his wisdom, that he was going to make the design responsibility for the temporary works the responsibility of the main contractor. And that happens all the time, because what happens is you get professional services people that are bang up against it price-wise because they want to give the client value. So anything that they can outsource to specialist subcontractors, they will. But you can't take a 14-inch wall that's 17 metres high, front to back, that separates two villas out without any temporary works. Who wants to know what the guy said when we challenged his design? So a show of hands. Anybody want to know what he said? Probably the most idiotic thing I've ever heard in construction, and I've heard a few things in 40 years. He said, it'll be all right, because when you put all the partitions in, they'll provide some restraint. He's a partner in one of the biggest structural engineering companies in this country, and he's still employed to this day. These people do walk amongst us. I know it's scary, but they do. Checking out the credentials of people and going and getting references from people about what they actually do is so crucial. You know, how many people take references for people about what they're going to do? I know I do. Do I always follow them up? In business, yes. Personally, not always. It's absolutely crucial. because it happens all the time. We engaged an architect to do some work, design work for us on our house. And we engaged with him, we used him, it was a really good experience. He'd had a problem where his PI insurance had been called on because he designed an extension for a domestic client. It was about a £200,000 project. Tendered it, wasn't involved in the supervision. He was involved in the tender and the selection. The contractor that was chosen to do this extension decided, in his wisdom, that when he dug the footings down and found some tree roots from some nearby ley land, he didn't fancy digging any deeper because it was an all-risk groundwork package, that he'd cut all the roots off and just bang a bit of clay back in. So that when the building control officer came around to do the compliance checks, he passed off the footing and they pulled it. After he'd finished the build, he liquidated his company, and 6 months later, the back of this double-storey extension on this really big five-bedroom executive house, you could get your fist in the gap at the top of the wall. Because the extension was doing this and moving away like that. And because the building company had gone bust, the homeowner's insurer went after the architect. Engaging with who you engage with, rather, is so important. Not just getting people that you think can do it, but go out and sense check what they're telling you. Getting this stuff done at the beginning will save you not just time further on down the line, but it will save you money. And engaging with the right contractor is so important. Now, what I do not, just to be clear, mean by that is come and give me your work, because that's not what I'm here for, okay? So just to be clear on that. What I'm saying is go and get contractors that know what they're doing. Talk to them about how they operate their business. Go and look at their projects. Go and have a look at how they're operating and delivering their work. Is it systemized? Does it make sense the way things are being done? Are there materials just strewn everywhere? Because the best businesses to work with are the ones that have got systems within their company. They might not all have ISO 9001 accreditation. I haven't got it. But the systems I use have been accredited and re-accredited for 15 years. I choose not to now because it doesn't serve me and it doesn't serve my clients. And we're moving away from contracting. But we still use systems in everything we do. And there's a reason, because systems save you sanity, time, emotion, and your mental well-being. Who here knows what a scalextrics track is? Right. It's a system. The first time you put a car around a scalextrics track, you tend to go a little bit slowly. That's like doing your first refurb, if you're sensible. But by the time you've done 20, you can almost do them with your eyes shut, because it's systemized. And systems don't have to be, you know, you go into companies. I mean, I did some training at John Lang's when I first left school. We had a cupboard for the process manual. I kid you not, there's businesses now that have got server rooms that weren't that big. But these days, it's far more simplified and far more streamlined. But engage with contractors that actually have that sort of stuff. Yes, it might be 1% or 2% more. And yes, it might mean that not every one of your deals stacks up. But what's better? To not have two deals that don't stack up, or to have something that you've then built that's a physical thing in a field or in someone's garden that all too late you realise doesn't stack up when it falls down around your ears? Because that's the reality of not getting this stuff right. Whether it's CDM and health and safety, whether it's the tax stuff, the whole compliance part is so important. And it isn't actually that difficult to do. Who's had a scaffold on a project? Just have a show of hands anyone has a scaffold. So who here knows what the requirements are for that scaffold to be put up? Before you even put it up. Okay, it should be designed. Yep. There's two ways you can do it. There's a really, really straightforward, simple way on what's called an NASC guidance sheet, which is basically, I think there's about 26 different styles of scaffold that the National Association have designed and said, you can go and build that, it's safe. We've engineering checked it, that's safe. Anything more than that should be designed. It doesn't have to be expensive. We've done hanging scaffolds over the River Thames. And the design for that, which was about 250 grand scaffold, cost about £5,000. Which is a drop in the ocean in the scale of literally, it didn't drop in the ocean, but thankfully we did come a bit close with a couple of fittings, I've got to be honest. But in relative terms to the scale of what we were doing, it's a tiny sum of money. But if you're just literally putting an extension up or doing a loft conversion, that scaffold can be done on a design sheet. And if you're engaging with the right scaffolder and not some transit bandit, they'll know what that means and they'll know what's required. And the difference is probably between paying £600 and £800. But the reality in terms of the difference of outcome is going to be huge. And who here loves going on their sites and taking photos? Most people, right? You want to be on a scaffold that's safe. It doesn't have to be difficult. But the other thing that people miss every single time, by law, they have to be inspected every 7 days at the most. And that's not a, yeah, I fancy a jolly, we've not been out for a month. It's law. You have to do that. And you also have to do it after every eventuality of adverse weather. So when it was windy back end of last year and we'd got a scaffold up in Swindon, guess who had to drive to Swindon every other day to go and inspect a scaffold? Muggins here, because I've got the tickets to do it. And it's not particularly complicated. I'm fortunate I've spent a lot of time in the scaffold industry, but it's not particularly hard to do. But if you don't do it and that scaffold falls over for no reason, so you can have a lorry drive into it, you can have something happen in a high street and something ricochet off of it. So it's nothing that's anything wrong with your scaffold and that falls down. What do you think the HSE will say? Where's your inspection? Oh, we haven't got one. Okay. Well, we're not interested in anybody else. You're getting fined. Their fee for intervention, which is what they dress up as we've come to site and nicked you for something, in layman's terms, starts at £2,000. Their average fee for intervention is over £20,000. And if they decide to prosecute you, they're successful in over 75% of cases. They don't muck about. They really don't muck about. Safety is a really, really important thing. Just last week on who's heard of HS2? I'm not interested in the politics of whether it should or shouldn't be built, because that's a whole different talk. Their budget last year for safety was £3 billion for safety. Not for constructing anything, for safety. Someone got killed on one of their jobs last week. A 24-year-old electrician. Not even fully qualified. And that is despite having a full risk assessment, full method statement, full plan of work, full interface manager, 5 layers of management, and every bit of safety that you could think of, and a load of stuff that you can't, and stuff I can't even think about because I don't do rail work, that still went wrong. So if that can still go wrong with that amount of planning, why do people in property think it's okay to just smash a refurb through and just decide to take a wall out of a property without any kind of thought and planning? Because that's the reality of what happens all too often. And it doesn't have to cost loads more money. It doesn't have to take loads longer to do it right. And I would implore you that if you're going to be doing property refurbishment of any scale whatsoever, just put those simple steps in place, because you will sleep a lot better at night, you'll be a lot safer when you set foot on site, and you'll know that not only are you doing it right for you, but the companies that you engage, you're creating a safe working environment for those people too. Who would want to go to work if their desk was 36 metres up in the air on the end of a rope on the end of a crane? Not many of you would want to go and work in that environment. Scotty would, for different reasons. But people expect people in the trades to go and work on dangerous scaffolds, on dangerous roofs, with no thought or care for their safety whatsoever. They're human beings as well. The construction industry's got a really bad rep for being full of hairy ass geezers with their ass crack hanging out, shouting and wolf whistling at people. And yeah, some of us do exist. But I'll try not to. I talk on stage nowadays instead. But modern day tradesmen are not like that. We need to respect the people that are constructing and maintaining our assets, because every year the battle to get decent tradesmen is harder and harder. Who here has found that it's hard to get guys on site or girls or whoever to come and do some work, whether it's build something, maintain something? Who here has had that challenge? Right. The very people that can solve that problem are the very people that have just put their hand up. I speak at colleges and different charities regularly, and one of the barriers for getting people to come into the construction industry is that they think it's all mud and bullets and a horrible environment and not nice, because it's stuck in that stereotype that's set 20, 30 years ago, back when I was in that first footing 40 years ago. That isn't the modern construction industry, and it doesn't have to be. But we have to do stuff to make it a better environment. And if you want to get decent people onto your projects to do your refurbishments, the way to do that is to set your stall out properly by setting it up properly, engaging people properly, getting specialists like JosTech to sort out your compliance and getting your thermals done and getting your testing done, so that actually you're setting your stall out right. You will get a better quality of trades that will want to work on your project by taking that approach than you will by trying to nick a fiver here or a tenner there, or is that your best price, mate? Come on, really, you can do as a bit of a deal. Is there ever something more insulting than that question? The best way to get the best outcome is to invest the time at the beginning, have honest, frank conversations with people, and get stuff documented properly. That's what will give you your outcomes the way you want them to be. And ultimately, that's what will make it scalable. Because if it's successful and it's systemized, it's going to make it easier for you to do it again, because you're going to have more appetite, you're going to have invested less time, emotion, and part of your mental sanity in getting to the end, because everybody gets fixated on the destination. But actually, it's not the destination that turns off people's appetite to do deals again. It's actually the fact that the journey is so painful for getting a project to the end that they don't ever want to do it again. Who's heard of people having nightmares getting building projects finished? So with a show of hands, who's heard that story? Yeah. It's that sort of stuff that puts people off, more so than them never getting to the end, because they do ultimately get to the end. There's a story just this week about the guy that built the £10 million house hanging off the side of a cliff that's cost him his marriage and cost him £10 million. It's Grand Design's saddest ever story. And he summed it up by saying that he'd got a master's in borrowing, a PhD in debt recovery, because he's trying to mask what is lost with humour. But the really sad thing is that actually, if all of that simple stuff had been done at the beginning, you might argue he probably would never have tried to build the thing in the first place, because it was built from emotion, not from a financial or commercial point of view. But even so, the outcome would have been a lot different. Instead, he tried to design it and build it as he went, thinking on his feet. You can't do that on a job that's bigger than £5,000. You can't be managing the design for something that you've got guys on site on 10 grand a day. Because guess what? When you come to settle their final account, they're not going to magically forget the 20 days at 10 grand a day where you couldn't make a decision. It's so important. Do the basic paperwork at the beginning. Be clear on what you want. Have systems in place to make that happen, and engage with professionals. Set up and get stuff sorted out with CDM. Get your health and safety stuff done. Get the HSE stuff done. Get the HMRC stuff done, so register for the right tax status. Get all of those boxes ticked. They don't cost money, but they do ultimately save you sanity. And with that, I'm done.
Okay, Richard, that was absolutely fantastic. So for people listening into the podcast, if they wanted to reach out to you, to contact you, maybe enlist your services, what would be the best way for them to do that?
Okay, the best way is social media. I'm Richard Stone on LinkedIn. I'm rmstone2011 on Instagram. Either of those two, fine, drop me a message. I'm pretty prolific on both, so reach out and we can have a conversation.
Fantastic. Okay, round of applause, everyone, for Richard Stone.
Thank you for listening to the Serviced Accommodation Property Podcast. You can also follow me on social media and YouTube by searching The Property Soldier. Also, check out my website, www.propertysoldier.co.uk, where you can learn even more about property investing and serviced accommodation.